Thank you, Michael. I guess I have 5 minutes less now after that introduction. I was asked to talk about how PrEP might fit into the National HIV/AIDS strategy, and hopefully all of you in the room know that in July 2010, the president released the first ever national comprehensive HIV strategy for the United States. And so that's what I'm going to do this afternoon. And let's begin by, we're not going to review the entire strategy, but one of the major goals of the National HIV/AIDS strategy is to reduce HIV incidence. And clearly, when we're talking about the use of antiretrovirals for high-risk seronegative individuals, we're talking about it in the context of preventing the acquisition of HIV. So it's important to recognize that the national strategy under the reduction of HIV incidence had three major activities: to intensify HIV prevention efforts in hard-hit communities, to expand or scale up combinations of effective approaches, and to educate all Americans about HIV. And while I think all three of them are extremely important, the first two in particular are very relevant to any discussions that we might have about PrEP. Now, as has been pointed out by previous panelists, when we're talking about hard-hit populations, gay and bisexual men in the United States certainly are certainly fit that bill. The CDC this summer released new estimates of HIV incidence and noted that for the last several years, between 2006 and 2009, that HIV incidence, in other words, the number of new HIV infections in the United States, has been relatively stable at about 50,000 infections a year. Now, that's not an insubstantial number, and certainly we would like to see that number greatly reduced, but I think it's important to put it in context and recognize that at the height of the epidemic in the United States in the late 1980s and early 90s, it's estimated that there were about 130,000 new infections every year in the United States. And let me just say, for the record, I hope everyone recognizes that in the U.S., there is no gender, no racial ethnic group, no sexual orientation immune from HIV infection, as the next bullet demonstrates. But we also have to recognize that in the U.S., most of our new HIV infections are occurring among men who have sex with men. And we use that term to include both gay-identified men, bisexual men, men who call themselves heterosexual but have sex with other men, etc. So when we talk about hard-hit populations, hard-hit by HIV, I think that you can appreciate why there's such potential interest in the ability of PrEP to reduce the number of new infections. Also, very worth pointing out, this analysis, by the way, that was published in PLOS ONE by CDC is worth a read if you haven't read it. And it certainly underscores the disparities by race, ethnicity, but very important to point out that the CDC scientists observed that the only group in this time interval, and these were estimates, very sophisticated estimates, but estimates, the only group that is estimated to have had increases in incidence over this time period are young, black, gay, and bisexual men. Now, I won't review all of this because it has been discussed ad nauseum by our other two speakers, but I do want to point out the two points that are worth repeating over and over and over again is that in the successful trials, and there have been, at least in terms of oral preparations, there have been three randomized control trials that have demonstrated efficacy. But in those trials, as was pointed out by both of my fellow panelists before me, the efficacy was highly related to adherence. We cannot forget that. Highly related to adherence. The other point that they mentioned, but it's worth underscoring with a bright red line, is that in these studies, PrEP was not administered alone as the prevention modality. In fact, it was part of a comprehensive package of HIV prevention services that included risk reduction counseling on an ongoing basis, access to condoms, and diagnosis and treatment of STIs. So that's a really important issue to think about when we think about PrEP. I mean, we talk about it in shorthand, but in none of these studies was it just, here's the pill, go take it, let's see what happens. And that's a real important issue to keep in mind. I want to summarize again, this was mentioned in one way or another by both Rick and Ken, but we don't know the effectiveness of PrEP in a real-world setting. We know the efficacy in a structured, scientific, randomized controlled trial, but we don't know in the real world what will happen, and that's been highlighted. We don't know what will happen at the consumer level. We're not sure what will happen at the community level. We're not exactly sure what might happen at the provider level. I think another major issue, and CDC and NIH and other folks are thinking about this very critically, is no one is suggesting, even if we had all the money in the world, and P.S. we don't, no one is suggesting that every high-risk, sexually active, gay and bisexual man should be a candidate for PrEP. So there's some real serious discussion about how do we target this intervention and pinpoint it, both because of the cost involved. We don't know what the long-term consequences are. You saw the data on bone density. There are other issues that could turn up. So how do we identify the small subset of MSM who might benefit from this as a prevention modality? And the Rick's last slide, how do we operationalize it? Again, it's all of you know, we talk a great deal in public health science about translation, dissemination of findings. There are many steps that have to take place when we move from the scientific domain of a highly structured, randomized controlled trial to a real-world setting. How do we operationalize that? Long-term health consequences remain a question. Both of the speakers before me talked about the possibility of risk behavior rebounding now because of PrEP. So, and I think finally the issue of cost. I mean, we have to be upfront and say we've got people on waiting lists in the United States to access publicly, these are HIV infected individuals who are waiting to access public funds for HIV drugs. How do we balance that now with the ability to provide treatment for people who are not infected? And it's a real issue. Now, you know, we might not have the most sensitive tests in the world for HIV diagnosis routinely available, but I would posit that we've still got problems with people even knowing their serostatus. And I think whatever one thinks about PrEP, you have to recognize after our first two speakers, a person must know, and we're talking about MSM now, of course it could apply to women, but a person must know his serostatus. The provider must know that individual's serostatus to even be able to consider whether or not PrEP is an option. And as these data from CDC show, we don't, I think all of you recognize, we don't have a national electronic medical record in this country, so we can't go to a single place and figure out how many people in the United States have been tested for HIV, so we have to rely on important surveys like the National Health Interview Survey to get a snapshot of how many adults have been tested for HIV. Now, here, step away from MSM. Here we're talking about adults between the ages of 18 and 64 who have ever been tested for HIV. Now, the good news is that we are seeing some increases, but the sobering news is that more than half of U.S. adults have never been tested for HIV, and even among those who are tested, about a third are so-called late diagnoses. So about a third of those individuals found to be positive go on to develop AIDS within 12 months, which, because of what we know about the natural history of the virus, means they've been infected for years and haven't been diagnosed. So there's a problem right there. You've got to know serostatus. That problem is intensified when we're talking about men who have sex with men. Other important data from CDC's National Health Behavior Survey, looking at over 8,000 MSM interviewed in 21 metropolitan statistical areas in the United States, the shocking finding that nearly one in five were infected with HIV. And if you looked at black MSM, it was nearly one in three. But scroll down to the bottom, almost half, 44%, were unaware of their HIV infection. And this isn't really about the window period. This is about not being tested on a regular basis. So, I mean, there's an issue right there we have to grapple with. Now, it's not just the consumer who bears some responsibility here. This is a paper that looked at how often providers were offering screening to their gay and bisexual clients. This was information was actually provided online by MSM, who were asked back in 2009, had you been previously tested for HIV, and were you offered an HIV test by your provider in the last year? And only 30%. This is 3 years after CDC went on record and said that risk-based testing is no longer the way to go, that in every routine clinical encounter, the provider should offer HIV testing to his or her client, regardless of what you think about their risk behaviors. And this is obviously one of the reasons why CDC is saying this. You can't always tell what an individual's risk behavior is. An individual may not feel comfortable sharing that information with a provider. And oftentimes, this is especially true for women, people may not even think that they're at risk. So we've got some issues, even before we get into the cost and how we operationalize it, we have some really basic issues about people need to know their serostatus. And the estimated 20% of people in America who are infected with HIV and don't know it need to get diagnosed, not only for their own individual health benefit, but also for the public health benefit that can accrue from that. Now, this, I talked about one of the issues that we're dealing with now is trying to identify, again, if we hold constant the issue of cost, if we hold some of the other issues constant, we still have the issue of, we're not talking about making this available to every HIV uninfected gay and bisexual man in the United States. So how do we kind of start to hone down who might be appropriate candidates? This was a really interesting study that was just published last year from folks out of the San Francisco Municipal STD Clinic. And it was a retrospective study. What they did was look at over 500, these were HIV negative, gay and bisexual men who presented with rectal gonorrhea, that's the GC, or chlamydia, that's the CT. And it was a retrospective study, but basically what they did then was look at how many of those people went on to seroconvert. And the bottom line here is that they found that men who had two prior episodes of rectal or gonococcal chlamydia in the past 2 years had an HIV incidence of 15%. So one thing you might start to think of, it not only, as Rick pointed out, are STD providers might be logical places to think about, but trying to identify particular subsets of men who we know are at extremely high risk for becoming infected with HIV. Now, again, this doesn't deal with any other of the important complexities like drug use or mental health issues, but it starts to get us in the direction of how do we identify potential subsets of individuals who might benefit from this. But so that's at the top of the list. And I think here's the major point I want to make. There is there's a lot of interest in the role that PrEP might play in helping us reduce HIV incidence among gay and bisexual men in the United States. I think we can all agree at that level. But I think what we have to recognize, as both of the presenters before me identified, and I suspect the final presenter will identify, this is not a magic bullet. Remember that the slide that I showed you, the first slide I showed you about incident, the goals of incidents, and I talked about what combination of intervention should be scaled up. I think our challenge with PrEP is to try to figure out how it fits into other approaches to prevent infection with HIV. So we know that we're going to have to work that through, and that's a very important issue across the prevention field now. Even if we weren't talking about PrEP, if you had someone from CDC up here talking about their new funding announcement, they would tell you that they're looking very carefully at what, and NIH as well. NIH is funding researchers to try to determine what combination of prevention interventions is going to result in the maximal payoff in terms of reducing new infections. And I think this is how we have to think about PrEP. How does it fit into that equation? Again, want to say it over and over and over again. None of the successful randomized control trials just provided PrEP. They provided PrEP as part of a comprehensive prevention strategy, and that's going to be extremely important. I think it's clear, and all of my two colleagues before have pointed this out, that often what successful trials do is raise more questions. And so we've heard a lot from, Ken and Rick did a great job of talking about, now we're thinking about, are there other antiretrovirals? Are there intermittent dosing schedules that will work? What are some of the long-acting delivery systems that we might consider? But I think clearly, and Rick pointed this out, we have to understand from both the consumer perspective and the provider perspective, what is the acceptability of this? Just because something has been shown to work in a randomized controlled trial doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be acceptable, or you can't necessarily predict uptake. And we have to really learn more about that. And certainly we have to invest in modeling that will help us understand how PrEP fits into other prevention modalities. So let me end with this point. I do think there's potential in PrEP. We all recognize that when we're talking about gay and bisexual men, we're talking about populations in the United States, and the strategy is focused on the U.S. That's why my comments are focused on the U.S. We are talking about populations that bear a disproportionate burden with HIV/AIDS. So I think there's a lot of potential there, but we have to figure out how it fits in to an overall prevention package if we want to achieve the vision of the National HIV/AIDS Strategy. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron. Our last speaker before we open up, and we're running just a little bit behind, so I implore you to stay around and ask questions. Dr. Jose Nanu. Pardon me. Nanny. Excuse me. Is Associate Professor of Community Health in the Department of Health, Physical Education, and Recreation at Kingsborough Community College of the City University of New York. He also serves as Adjunct Associate Professor of Health Education at Teachers College, Columbia University, and is a faculty affiliate with the Center for HIV Educational Studies and Training at Hunter College. He possesses a master's degree in health education, specialization in human sexuality from New York University, and a Doctor of Education degree in health education from Teachers College, Columbia University. For over 22 years, Jose has been involved in numerous efforts entailing sexuality education and sexual health research, including HIV prevention. His research interests include investigating behavioral and contextual factors affecting the biopsychological biosocial psychological health of gay and bisexual men, assessing sexual protective and risk behaviors, as well as psychological resilience among men of color who have sex with men and other sub-communities of gay and bisexual men. I welcome you.